Blog Talk Radio.
Inhabitants, who are the sole creators of a civilization whose technology gives us absolute mastery of the world if we want it. We, whose Christian civilization, for all its defects, is in comparison with others as superior morally as it is technologically, have we lost the will to live? That is a question that any observer must ask when he sees the incredible spectacle of a great nation taxing itself to nourish cannibals, draining away its economic blood to arm Bolsheviks, tolerating in its own midst the systematic breeding with its own money of degeneracy and crime. Have our minds become so befuddled by the hypocritical jabbering of unhuman invaders and the babbling of our own fools that we have lost even the instinct of self-preservation? If indeed we have, then by the irrevocable law of nature, we have become like the dinosaurs, the dodos, and the mountain gorillas, biologically obsolete, and the world will soon know us no more.
maidens, welcome, greetings. This is Ragnarok Now with me, your host, Siegfried, broadcasting to you live from Long Island, New York, on this
fair
17th of May, 2013. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you very much. Thank you, Renegade Broadcasting, for again giving me the chance to broadcast here. Thank you very much. Whether you're listening live or in the archives, again, I thank you. You can join me and the rest of the audience on the official chat room, which is easily accessible at renegadebroadcasting.com. You may also call into the show by ways of Skype. And the phone number is 347-633-9657, 347-633-9657. Today's show is going to be like most of the other broadcasts I have put out, merely just music and musings, and the events of today, which I will go over right now. On May the 17th, 1792, the New York Stock Exchange is formed. In 1865, the International Telegraph Union and later International Telecommunication Union is established. 1902, Greek archaeologist Valerios Stais discovers the Antikythera mechanism, an ancient mechanical analog computer. In 1933, Vidkun Quisling and Johann Wilhelm Hoth form Nasjonal Samling, the National Socialist Party of Norway. In 1940, Germany occupies Brussels, Belgium. And just last week, I mentioned that on May the 10th, Germany invades Belgium, so it took them about a week to take over the capital. Wow. Anyway, 1954, on May the 17th, the United States Supreme Court hands down the Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas decision outlawing segregation in public schools. Wow, that is very important. In 1970, Thor Heyerdahl sets sail from Morocco on the papyrus boat Ra II to sail the Atlantic Ocean. 1973, we have the Watergate scandal. Hearings begin in the United States Senate and are televised. 1974, police in Los Angeles, California raid the Sibionese Liberation Army's headquarters. In 1983, Lebanon, Israel, and the United States sign an agreement on Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon. Which did a lot of good that did, yeah. Anyway, 1995, after 18 years as the mayor of Paris, Jacques Chirac takes office as president of France. Oh, goody. And a few famous births and deaths. Two very important men died. Some of my favorite historical figures died on this day, but first of the births. 1911, we have Maureen O'Sullivan, who's an Irish actress. She was born. 1936, a famous sellout and hippie icon, actor and director, Dennis Hopper is born. And Anya, the Irish singer and songwriter, born in 61. And for the deaths, we have 1727, Catherine I of Russia. 1829, it was John Jay, first Chief Justice of the United States. 1886, John Deere, American blacksmith and manufacturer, died this day. And 1919, we have Guido von Liszt, Austrian occultist, die. And in 1992, Lawrence Welk, American musician and conductor. And now that I mentioned music with that last death, I forgot to cite the intro song for today that was playing me in just now. That was A New Ice Age by Woden's Woods out of England. So thank you very much to them for the music. That is the, at least to my knowledge, the first, for sure, comrade-created piece of music I've played on the show. Everything else I've really played is either 60s music or Baroque concertos or something. But yeah, that's original music. So if you want your original pro-white music playing live on a platform like this, please email me. You can email me at ZiegfriedS.1700@gmail.com. That is ZiegfriedS.1700@gmail.com. Or just go to RagnarokNow.com and you can find my contact information there at the top right. Oh, and you can always reach me on Skype at The Hungry Hun, all one word. Now, today's show I entitled The Proving Grounds. The Proving Grounds, I wanted to call it something like the muster field. To my belief, this time is so important, and so much rests on my generation's shoulders, and, for some reason, we don't like to blame the older generations, they let all slide by. We didn't have a choice, man. I was just going along with the hippie stuff, man. Well, there's really no excuse for that nowadays, so that's kind of what the show is going to be about. It's going to be about nature. It's going to be about race. And it's going to be about what is perhaps needed. I went over such last show, and this show won't be any different, besides for the fact that I'm reading from two rather famous people, one a bit more famous because he's older and dead. That is one Immanuel Kant, but we'll get to that later. And the other writer is none other than Severus from Niflson's blog. I'll be reading from his blog in a bit. Before we get to that, we're going to have musical break. This is by Francesco Saverio Gemignani. Let's see what piece I have. I believe it's just a concerto. We'll play that. Come back. Read from Severus. Take your calls, if they even come in. Because, quite frankly, I'm very disappointed with you people, and you have yet to prove yourself. So please call in. Again, that number is 347-633-9657. Tell me what you think about this Jewish world. Tell me what you think about the minds ensnared by Jewish bullshit. Please call in and tell me how you feel about it, because chances are, if you're white and suburban especially, you will have similar stories you can tell. We'll go to the Gemignani concerto in E minor, and we'll come back after that. Stay tuned, please. Welcome back. So, a tradition I have doing these broadcasts is to read a description of a battle that occurred on or during this day. And that battle I have in mind, it was a toss-up between the Siege of Vicksburg and the War of Northern Aggression, or the Battle of Monte Cassino, which is, of course, from World War II, because on the 18th of May is actually when that battle ended. So I'm going to read from Metapedia the description of that whole thing, in case you were unaware of it. The Battle of Monte Cassino, or also known as the Battle for Rome and the Battle for Cassino, was a costly series of four battles during World War II, fought by the Allies with the intention of breaking through the Winter Line and seizing Rome. In the beginning of 1944, the western half of the Gustav Line was being anchored by Germans, holding the Rapido, Liri, and Galliano valleys, and certain surrounding peaks and ridges, but not the historic Abbey of Monte Cassino, founded in AD 524 by Saint Benedict. Although they manned defensive positions set into the steep slopes below the abbey walls. On February 15th, the monastery, high on a peak overlooking the town of Cassino, was destroyed by American B-17, B-25, and B-26 bombers. The bombing was based on the fear that the abbey was being used as a lookout post for the Axis defenders. This position evolved over time to admit that Axis military was not garrisoned there. 2 days after the bombing, German paratroopers poured into the ruins to defend it. From January 17th to May 18th, the Gustav defenses were assaulted 4 times by Allied troops. These operations resulted in casualties of over 54,000 Allied and 20,000 German soldiers. Reference required on that, but those are the numbers. I knew they were high, but I know not if that's truly how high they were. Here's the background. The Allied landings in Italy in September 1943 by two Allied armies commanded by General Sir Harold Alexander, Commander-in-Chief Allied Armies in Italy, were followed by an advance northward on two fronts, one on each side of the central mountain range forming the spine of Italy. On the western front, the U.S. 5th Army, commanded by Lieutenant General Mark W. Clark, moved from the main base of Naples up the Italian boot, and in the east, General Sir Bernard Montgomery and his British 8th Army advanced up the Adriatic coast. The 5th Army made slow progress in the face of difficult terrain, wet weather, and skillful German defenses. The Germans were fighting from a series of prepared positions in a manner designed to inflict maximum damage, of course, then pulling back and so buying time for the construction of the Winter Line defensive positions south of Rome. The original estimates that Rome would fall by October 1943 proved too much optimistic. Although in the east, the Winter Line had been breached on the British 8th Army's Adriatic Front and Ortona was captured, the advance and had ground to a halt with the onset of winter blizzards at the end of December, making close air support and movement in the jagged terrain impossible. The route to Rome from the east using Route 5 was thus excluded as a viable option, leaving the routes from Naples to Rome, Highways 6 and 7, as the only possibilities. Highway 7, the old Roman Appian Way, followed along the west coast, but south of Rome ran into the Pontine Marshes, which the Germans had flooded. Highway 6 ran through the Liri Valley. Dominating the south entrance to this valley was the hill mass behind the town of Cassino. Excellent observation from the peaks of several hills allowed the German defenders to detect Allied movement, prevent any advance northward, and direct artillery fire on Allied units. Running across the Allied line of advance was the fast-flowing Rapido River, which rose in the central Apennine Mountains, flowed through Cassino and across the entrance into the Liri Valley, after which its name changed to the River Galliano, and it continued to the sea. With its heavily fortified mountain defenses, difficult river crossings, not only was the river fast flowing, but the Germans had temporarily diverted the Rapido at the head of the valley so as to flood the valley bottom and make conditions underfoot most difficult for any attackers, Cassino formed a linchpin in the Gustav Line, the most formidable line of the defensive positions making up the Winter Line. Because of the historical significance of the Benedictine Monastery, in December 1943, the German commander-in-chief in Italy, Feldmarschall Albert Kesselring, ordered German units not to include the monastery itself in German defensive positions and inform the Allies accordingly. Controversy exists regarding the extent to which this order was followed. Some Allied reconnaissance aircraft reported seeing German troops inside the monastery. The monastery had excellent observation of the surrounding hills and valleys, and thus was a natural site for German artillery observers. What is clear is that once the monastery was destroyed, the Germans occupied it and made use of the rubble to build defensive positions. Ultimately, however, the military arguments leading to the monastery's destruction rested on its potential threat, real or imagined, rather than its actual state of occupation. There was a final destruction on February 15, 1944, when during the Battle of Monte Cassino, the entire building was pulverized in a series of heavy air raids due to the mistaken belief that it was a German stronghold. In fact, the abbey was being used as a refuge from the battle by the women and children of nearby Cassino. So, there you go. Another nice war atrocity for you, greatest generation, to feel so proud about. Oh, yeah, we beat those evil Germans and the evil Italian civilians. Great job, guys. Wow. Thank you, Monty. Thanks, Jews. You're the best, as Kyle says. Let's see, now I had, like I planned, I was going to read from Niffelsen's blog, which I will do now. And, well, Mr. Severus, his 6 points are sort of making the rounds as far as I can tell. I think I saw it on the End of Zion blog, another great site I've mentioned before on the broadcast. I should get him on the show, if he wants to. That's a on-the-air live invite to the End of Zion. You can look up that site, theendofzion.com, I believe it is. Yep, The End of Zion, one word, theendofzion.com. Go check that out. Great blog, another great allied blog. Not the bad kind of ally that I was just talking about, the good, the contemporary type of ally that we need. Go to that site, but I'll be reading. He featured the 6 basics of European racialism as written by Severus. And that blog I'm reading from right now is niflson.blogspot.com, niflson.blogspot.com. Featured on there is his 6 points. I'm going to read them right now. This is what he writes. As requested by my readers, here I post my 6 basics of European racialism, what some call white nationalism. The purpose of this list is to summarize the basic ontological premises of those who call themselves white nationalists, or its many derivatives, but somehow get lost in the vast ocean of ideologies within it, inadvertently further propagating confusion and division. In my opinion, if you believe the basics below, you are part of our movement. So before I read these, yeah, you're not part of the movement if you're Antifa. You're not part of the movement if you're you got some wacky idea of anthropology that's not derived from, doesn't derive from facts. So here we go. Number one, race is a biological reality. It isn't a social construct and is not only a spiritual cultural concept. It is clearly identified through observable methods and DNA. Number two, the European or white slash Aryan race is unique. In the larger context of history, culture, and achievement, the European race is special and thus worth preserving. Number three, history can only be understood through a racial lens. Very important point. Race must be the core evaluation methodology of history and the analysis of civilization itself. Organic reality cannot be ignored while studying the past. Number four, race mixing is genocide. If race is a reality and the European race is unique, Altering its essential genetic structure is obviously destructive and evil. Preservation is thus a moral obligation, even from an ecological standpoint. Absolutely right. Number five, here's a personal favorite point of mine. Number five, Jewish people are not, I repeat, Jewish people are not of the European race. Jews are a genetically distinct people. Fine by me. And thus not part of the European racial family. Even more fine by me. Their own racial identity is in fact defined by its very hostility towards every other people in the world, especially Europeans. And lastly, number six, patriarchy is the only natural structure of authority for the European race. Since gender is a biological reality, the roles assumed by them are rooted in organically developed forms of organization through millennia of experience. Patriarchal authority is clearly the most effective method of organizing the communities of the European race in particular. Now, I'd have to agree with that as well. Well said by Severus. It's sort of making its rounds. I just read it over the air here. Feel free to call me what you think. Call in, tell me what you think of the show, tell me what you think of those 6 points. I have my own writings here. Here I'm going to read in a second here. Just give me a second. I need some water. Okay. Why am I so parched? Well, I was at work all day. And I live in a very diverse place. Oh, yes. I see every single type of person imaginable, except for Australian Aborigines and, you know, and I do see Native Americans. I had a tax-exempt form from the group down in the Hamptons. I can't recall their name right now, but yeah, I mean, I see every type of person. So I got something to say about diversity. What I can say is that truly a good amount of all these individuals, no matter who they are pretty genteel and friendly. And to me, at least, as the cashier, I mean, but as far as diversity goes, well, it's very white, but at the same time, more diverse than the Founding Fathers could have ever imagined, so that's something to consider. That's just digressing, but I'd just like to... I'd like you to know where I'm coming from here. I'm coming from the very extremely diverse suburbs here in New York. But I'll talk about that more later when I get to my own writing. Here we go with Violent Aesthetics by Severus. One of the main tools in our enemy's repertoire, used to effectively displace Europeans from their own lands and influence, is the outright effeminization of our culture. Historically, civilization has always bred a weaker and delicate type of man. Simply because of the comfort of organized society naturally halts the process of culling the freaks and cowards who would have otherwise been killed, or at the very least would have been unable to compete for resources and healthy females. According to most researchers of human development, femininity itself is a result of a sedentary and protected lifestyle, more akin to the rightful place of a mother, daughter, and or wife, but less convenient for the responsibility entrusted by nature to males for the feeding, guarding, and leading of their family. It is inherent in the very arduous job of carrying, birthing, and nursing a child, itself a biological imperative only entrusted to the female gender, a need for a passive, submissive, and overly compassionate disposition. Chemically, when a mother hears her own child crying, her anxiety is purposefully triggered. Oxytocin levels rise dramatically and milk rushes to her breasts, so she can then nurture the child and quench his hunger. In said example, her emotional nature is in harmony with her natural responsibility, and thus it is healthy and productive. Men, on the other hand, serve a different natural and biological purpose, which is the reason they don't possess these hormonal responses to children crying, among other examples. These biochemical realities have been reflected in the spiritual cultural manifestations of our European forebears. The feminine was thus associated with nurturing, moonlight dancing, festive seasons, and the overarching theme of fertility and birth. The masculine was associated with protection, sunlight, war, and the eternal struggle for order and authority above and beyond the seasons. These archetypal reflections, as can be well observed, are connected to the biological chemical reality of our species functions and interacts with the natural world. As I have mentioned before, the separation / duality between the natural and the metaphysical is alien to the European soul. And I'd just like to add, you got Aries, you have Apollo, you have Heimdall, all these figures, gods, in our mythos, in our stories. You have Jason, you have all these figures. So as for the myths, there you go. You have our examples right there. We don't need any desert book to give us those examples, and they don't really do so. Moving on with the article. In our current predicament, where we find ourselves attacked from all possible flanks, and in which we fight for our very existence on this planet, our coherent understanding of natural reality is crucial to our victory. We must understand that nature has a set of laws that overrule any of our pedantic attempts to bypass them. No matter how creative we are to continue or become, I'm sorry, no matter how creative we are or continue to become. The inherent evil of liberal ideology, a disruptive mishmash of individualism, universalism, and consumerism, is that it purposefully divorces humans from their natural essence and attempts to promulgate the false idea that we have the capacity and or duty to overcome reality for the sake of freedom. They teach our children that they shouldn't be limited by anything that nature may throw their way, and instead that they should overcome reality itself with dreams and desires, unlike the heroic ethic of our ancestors, whose gods fought against the giants, an analogy of the chaotic forces of nature. Within the confines of the natural universe, the liberal ethic distances itself from nature, and for the sake of a disturbed desire to annihilate the world for their own selfish sake. If we are to revive our true character as native Europeans, we must stay close to nature and understand that we are subjects to higher laws and not to our own petty attempts at defining and controlling the universe. We must never forget that reality, that is, ancestry and environment, has already given us an identity, and we are therefore not in the market for a new one. This fact is, in a true sense, real transcendentalism, because true spirituality, in the European sense of the term, is not supernatural, outside of nature, but natural, within nature. Understanding racial reality, gender reality, and quality reality is inherently revolutionary in today's world because it breaks the agonizing fantasy matrix in which we have been imprisoned and begins to open the figurative window shades in expectation of nature's true disinfectant light. Those of us who have the honor to call ourselves Europeans, all of the children of Europe's racial and spiritual womb fall into this category, and those who also bear the responsibility of being males, must dedicate our energy to exalt and preserve the characteristics that such identifiers entail. A strong warrior ethic, embraced by the dignity of duty, and emboldened by the will to power through affirmative aggression, physical or symbolic depending on the context, is indeed the key value that will sustain our blood's drive to survive this onslaught. Our tradition in Europe, no matter from which particular ethnic group you hail from, has always been defined by martial valor and the beauty of strength. This has been true even when religions that preached peace and love had already overwhelmed our realms. Europeans have willfully ignored the tenets of philosophies that preach weakness and passivity in favor of creative interpretations that teach power and beauty, the legitimate children of true aristocracy. It is fair to say that our entire artistic expression has mostly been lopsided in favor of the apotheosis of war, its heroes, and the beauty which inspire their creation. It has been only very recently that our enemies have successfully turned our people, men in particular, into consumer-friendly, passive, effeminate, and deranged masochists. I have previously discussed the process of how this weakness consumes the very essence of a people, and how this eventually destroys our very awareness of being. So, my intention here is to particularly address whether or not we are capable as a movement to reverse the process effectively. Is it possible to sustain healthy levels of aggression, masculinity, and heroic values within a civilized society? We need only to look at countless past cultures of Europe and elsewhere to see examples of the possibility of doing just that. Rome, medieval Japan, National-Socialist Deutschland, Soviet Union, etc. Even the study of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and other martially obsessed cultures serve us as interesting contemporary case studies for the formulation of our own methods. Without a doubt, a comfort society reflects a passive/weak culture, and thus it dooms any people who accept it to death. In other words, for the sake of our survival, it would be preferable to live in a, quote, North Korea for Europeans, unquote, type of society than to live in our current demoralized culture of individualism and perversion. And a side note, I would have to agree with that. Hold on one sec here. Okay. A violent culture can therefore sustain values, levels of healthy aggressiveness within the confines of an alien and degenerate society. Arabs do this while in diaspora by hashing out violent imagery in the form of historiographies of great Mujahideen and other related cultural products aimed at their young men. Their cult of martyrdom is a good example of a self-sustaining system that advocates sacrifice for the sake of their community, not really for the personal benefit of the martyr, as the capitalist-obsessed Americans wish to interpret it. This methodology also shields them from the effects of consumerism and superficial mass culture, thus protecting their social cohesiveness, which again is fine by me. We don't have that type of thing, but that's deep within Islam, and Islam's not going to... No, it's never going to take over the European people. Thank the gods for that. And we have to have our own. That's just another side note of mine. We'll continue with the article now. Finish it up here. Therefore, sustaining high levels of violent aesthetics and dialectics can slowly turn our males thirsty for violent solutions to complex problems, a factor that will slowly revive their ancient spirit. The desire to revolutionize and destroy corruption in a quick and dramatic fashion is the renowned characteristic of youth. Shaping this into our favor is not only in our benefit, but in theirs. For the sake of European survival, the eulogizing of ancient warrior tribes, military heroes, and savage warlords will particularly engage our youth into the dynamic exaltation of their natural desire for glory and conquest. Most of our young love violent video games and movies for the same instinctive reasons, but their energy is being purposefully directed towards a passive/corrupt method of expression by our enemies. In the same way, a lot of contemporary music aimed at white children encourages lurid sexuality and passive entertainment/enjoyment, while the non-whites are encouraged to advocate hardcore violence and ghetto gun culture. Where is our violent subculture? For a while in the 1980s and the 1990s, Europeans had some forms of rock music and their ancillary art movements that provided exactly this violent aesthetic so needed in our contemporary culture. Bands formed whose main goal was to speak about the dangerous lifestyle of the white working class in the decaying cities of the world. Their appearance was aggressive. Their music was loud and threatening. Unfortunately, since their basic premise was predicated on hyper-individuality, their collective effect on our culture was limited. Another example was punk rock, a genre that slowly became politicized and slowly led towards a nihilistic fervor that cascaded into liberal politics and inevitably lost its masculine edge for the sake of political correctness and record contracts. So-called skinhead music also started developing wildly, up to the point in which a branch went off into a queer-like reggae dreamland, and other went into an aggressive reactionary chauvinism that amazingly enough inspired many people in our movement today. To be fair, the basic premise of the Rock Against Communism movement was very good, but the implementation was many more times than not productive. Ironically, with a few exceptions, it simply devolved into what characterizes most popular culture, a facilitated passive resistance in lieu of actual political work. Another music/culture genre example that is now becoming quite popular in Europe is National Socialist Black Metal. The aesthetics of this movement is quite interesting because they mix modern politics with almost medieval heathen theatrics. Black metal being the root of this art movement. Interestingly enough, a lot of young kids like this style because of the visual presentation and is quite violent and anti-Christian. Aesthetically speaking, the darker forms of cultural expression lure in a large swath of Europeans that are simply tired of the modern flamboyancy of mainstream culture and simply wish to rip it apart. Some even argue that the heathen soul of the European is still dormant, and thus is attracted archetypically to the darker and colder symbols of this type of art. Of course, the downside of this movement is that it focuses too much on the reverse Christian cliches and identity-swapping ridiculousness that will unfortunately turn off too many other revolutionary prospects. Let me be very clear, though. Now, I have always supported most artistic and ideological methods that promote our aims because, slowly but surely, the strong ones will overcome the weaker ones. And our cause can then go forward without so many divisions. It is basic social Darwinism, and it has been proven to work historically. Nonetheless, it is important to honestly assess how effective a cultural proposal/phenomenon is so that we can better organize ourselves for the final victory. That being said, music and visual art is just one aspect of the culture war, and usually the one most people choose because of how easy and personally isolated it is. This makes it the inferior approach to the culture war, albeit a part of it all the same. So, a lot of times brothers ask me the important question, what can I do right now for the European racialist cause? My answer is very specific and I believe easy for most to begin starting today. All of our men must start a family and serve in the role of a guide, protector, and provider. All of our men must make war in all of its cultural forms their core cultural value. All of our men must physically train in a gym and or engage in some form of exercise sport. All of our men must only purchase products that enhance their vitality, power, and strength. All of our men must legally purchase weapons and practice with them regularly. All of our men must dress in a manner that expresses stoic masculinity, never softness. All of our men must study history, philosophy, and literature, which actively elevates the values of duty, honor, and valor. All of our men must reject individualist values for the sake of collectivist ones. All Europeans are part of a community/organism. Real European men respect women and defend them because they indeed view their own role as protectors and theirs as the protected. Equality is a sham, and thus we unequally treat women in their favor. In the same fashion, real European men despise abuse and cowardly acts because their strength entails honor. Our enemy have no spine because their ancestry is one of low caste slaves who automatically abuse their power and when given the reins of authority. Europeans have always been a master race in the true sense of the term, thus instinctively shunning most displays of real tyranny. Therefore, European men never confuse aggressiveness with abusiveness because they are aware that only pathetic weaklings overcompensate. Basically, we must get our house in order before we can begin the actual work of destroying the current system to build a healthier one. Quoting the lunatic capitalist freak, Donald Trump, quote, "You should dress for the job you want and not the one you have, end quote. In the same vein, we cannot expect to build something that we haven't exemplified in ourselves. If we dream of a healthy and natural society, that we must start building it within our own personality and social surrounding. Our demeanor, attire, attitude, and actions must logically conform with our expectations of the world. I have no doubt that we will be victorious at the end of this journey, but I nonetheless try my best to help as much as I can in the process of making it happen sooner rather than later. Therefore, I work the hardest I can every single day and apply the strictest expectations of myself and of those over whom I am responsible. This is the only way I can honestly feel good as a European, as a man, as a father, and as a fighter for our collective cause. And that was Severus's Violent Aesthetics. We're already an hour into the show, and thus I will play the Locatelli piece I have uploaded for today. Let me try and find it for you. There we go. This is a Locatelli concerto in G minor, starting with, I believe, an allegro. Who knows? I'll post it up on RagnarokNow.com for you if you're interested. But here we go. I'll be back in just a few minutes. Stay tuned. Thank you. Well, hello there. This is Paul Joseph Watson reporting live. Siegfried, the Germanic death cult, Pontifex Maximus, he is missing now, so I will be filling in for him. Although I don't know what he wants to get to next, but I believe it has something to do with Ravillo P. Olive Garden, or perhaps another evil Nazi from the 18th century, Immanuel Kant. Yes, that's right, Paul. Yes, exactly. I actually wanted to read this before I got to the Severus writings. Welcome back, everybody. Well, that was Paul Joseph Watson. He's a contributor to PrisonPlanet.tv and Infowars.com. And, you know, this show, I like to jostle between, you know, relaxed and heady sort of topics, and people seem to like it thus far, and mayhaps liking it a lot today because I got finally a call. Let's pick up that call and turn off the Italian music. Here we go. This is 303 area code. You are live on Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Sig, it's Reed.
Oh, Reed. Welcome. Nice to hear you again.
Yeah, it's good to call in. I'm glad to see you over at Renegade.
Thank you.
Still get to enjoy your shows.
Oh, yeah.
And, Tuesday, I've been calling it a Danish show a couple times, because Tuesday, that was my day, but you used to be Tuesday on Truth, but now you're Friday,
yep.
But today I got time, so I called in, and I just wanted to make 2 points.
Sure.
One on the nature of race, and one on, you know, people awakening.
Go ahead.
Well, as far as people being awoken, and, well, I guess more specifically those who have been awoke,
mm-hmm.
I think that in a lot of individual cases, you know, there's been significant or challenging or traumatic events in younger life.
Yes.
Which can lead to, you know, a really fertile ground for an awakening. That can also lead to self-destruction. Just kind of depends on how you react to adversity and pain. But I think one of the problems, just real quickly, is that, you know, a lot of people today, you've had personal pain, which is what I'm talking about.
Right.
Sort of helps, because you don't really want to be involved in this upside-down world. You sort of escape that, and you get into your own mind for a while. And that can go many different ways. And
yeah, oh yeah.
Those types of people, which is, you know, basically a lot of how I experienced life, you know.
Yeah.
In my younger years leads to that. I mean, I'm not going to get into specifics about my personal life, but
sure, yeah.
I think that's important too, you know?
Yeah.
And then also on the nature of race, you know, you're talking about how reading that, whatever you're reading, you know, about race is, you know, derived, its foundation is in the natural world, it's in society,
yes.
It's in physiology, it's in mind, body, and spirit. But the one thing you didn't mention, which it's sort of on a more, I guess it's still on a spiritual level, but is blood, because I think the origins of race and why we react certain ways and why we do the things we do has a lot to do with keeping the blood pure. You know, it's like in that.
Let me just stop you quick. That was Severus's stuff. That wasn't any of my own creation. There was a tenet that race mixing is genocide. That he does make that very clear. So I guess that does entail your point. I suppose. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, my basic point is that if we keep our blood pure, which is, you know, what you had quoted that book in one of your shows in the past, Which Way, Western Man, and I know Simpson or whoever who wrote that, he talks a lot about how in today's modern society they always tell people, you know, opposites attract and mate with your opposite, whereas you should be looking for a woman who is, you know, similar to you.
Right.
Because that is your best chance of, you know, staying together.
Yeah, yeah.
Being in love and having children. And you
absolutely
have the same blood to sort of perpetuate those racial memories. You know, and that goes for all aspects of white society. You know, you got, you know, Mediterranean whites, Nordic whites, Germanic whites. You know, we're all pro-white here, but ideally Germanic whites, Irish whites, you know, they should be Irish, should be Irish, Germanic. You know, you sort of want to continue that lineage.
Yes, I agree, and you know, it's the Germanics were particularly good about that, as were all the ethnicities in the early days. I mean, before even my grandparents' day, that taboo was firmly in place. A Sicilian would not be dating an Italian. You know, it was that kind of stringent type of attitude that people in America had. You know, they weren't even immigrants. They were just Italian Americans who did not want their daughter hanging around a Sicilian. You know, they were very serious about that stuff. Reed, did you make all your points? I'll keep you on the line if.
Oh no, actually that's all right. I got to run. Glad to be able to call in and enjoying your show and keep up the good work.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Reed. Thanks for the call and thanks for your kind words. I appreciate that.
All right. Bye.
All right, take it easy. All right, we got another caller here. We'll go to that now. This is 254. 254, you are live with the Dramatic Death Cult Hotline.
Hello.
Hello, yes.
Hello, Siegfried. Hello,
yes.
Can you hear me?
Absolutely loud and clear. How are you, madam?
Okay, I'm great. I'm here with Mr. Sledge. He is my lover. And,
nice.
But I just wanted to call and say I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I like your hair. And, and I like it when you do Paul Joseph Watson. And, yes, because I think that's hilarious. And,
thank you.
Yes. And you're a verified bird, and yet you should find another redhead and have more redheads.
No, wait, whoa. Let me stop you there. You think I'm a redhead?
Are you not a redhead?
I am not. Oh, I think you're looking at that picture on the RenegadeBroadcasting.com.
Yeah, I am.
Okay,
a redhead?
Let me explain that picture there, madam. That was a...
Madam.
What would you prefer? Let me start there. What would you prefer? Miss?
Madam. Madam is all right.
Okay. Well, that picture is actually ripped from... and this is an exclusive tidbit here.
Uh-huh.
This is ripped from an official photo from a bar where I was playing, and they touched up that picture so everything looks redder. Like my lips are actually pretty naturally pretty red, but it looks like I have freaking lipstick on, and my hair is like really all red, and there's all these effects. Yeah, that's why I look the way I do in that picture. I'm actually a blonde, but my hair is really I'm dirty blonde right now. I'm unhealthy, and you know, I'm not in the sun as much as I should be, so it's pretty, pancake flavored hair. So
right.
Yeah, I'm a blonde. I'm a blonde. So
okay, all right. Well, that's good. I'm brunette, but
okay.
You know, I can't help that. But anyway, but my best friend's a redhead, and you know, I think that redheads are they're rarefied bunch. So you know, anyways, I try to fly with them.
Okay.
But we're all in this frame of mind. They're all that. Of the like mind, you know, it's here on Renegade, I guess. We're a verified bunch, you know, if you want to think like that. But I just want to call in and say that I enjoy your show. And, yeah, that's it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Yeah, so you're at a drop-off now, or?
Well, I don't know. We can talk about whatever.
Oh, okay.
Mike's in the other room.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I did.
He didn't want to talk tonight. He did all his talking last night.
Yeah, he did.
It was great, though.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was a good show. I want to make a few comments on that. You know, he had a good... That show and the show before that, he had a very good and very succinct breakdown of what was going on, as well as the banter between him and that first caller. He was, you know, white people, they've had a lot of gripes with not just, you know, the federal government, but the American society as a whole for, I don't know, over 100 years now, at least in the South.
Right.
And, you know, that's a really, really poor... image and truly wrong image of the world that they're pumping out there. And he was right. Mike was right to say that, because the media really does have the control and conveys that message to new Americans and non-Americans. So they all get this fake image
it's
of
true.
What America is like and what white America really is concerned about right now.
Yeah, Southerners are never the hero, no matter what.
Yeah.
You know, they're always portrayed as the fringe, the, you know, nutbag or whatever, you know, and it's not right, you know.
Yeah.
It's really not right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no mistake either. I mean, well, maybe it's a mistake, but it's no accident, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on purpose, and it's because I believe that we come from an authentic point of view. You know, we have legitimate rights, and
oh, yeah.
That's all overlooked, and it's all made out to be, you know, they were just, you know, fringe, you know, ladies, you know, silly Southerners, kids,
yeah.
Backwater, you know.
Oh, flyover country,
like
yeah.
We all agree.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Everything that people around here and places like this. I mean, there's suburban settings all over America. You got, you know, outside of Chicago and L.A. and San Francisco and Sacramento, and, you know, the list goes on. All these suburban whites, these domesticated babies. Their only knowledge of the South, and admittedly, almost all of my knowledge is hailed from the TV. And they
right.
really believe that stuff, and that's the saddest thing
yeah.
of all. They don't connect with these people. They don't care what's going on there. They're just stupid and backward Southerners. Who cares? Who cares?
Right. They take, you know, inaccurate portrayals as fact, and
yes,
I don't know how we'll overcome that. You know, because people don't venture out into the real world.
No,
they do everything second or third person. It's all secondhand knowledge, and they accept it as fact. Whereas, you know. I try to live my life and, you know, get out there amongst them, you know, and people just don't do that. And they don't have true experiences. And,
yeah.
you know, they go with other preconceived notions. And it colors their perspective and their perception of reality.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, and then that's what they count on. They count on ignorance, they count on laziness, and they count on animosity bred from their media, which has happened for, I don't know, since the Civil War. They sold the war out on those people and, you know, had very pious and mission-minded Union soldiers going over there, also soldiers forced into fighting by ways of the draft, and killed their fellow Americans. And they were all Christians. You know, they're all going to heaven, though. You got chaplains on both sides telling them they're on God's mission. And I mean, it's just so sad. And it's gotten to this point where, you know, again, these suburban peoples, they just worship Hollywood. They just never, ever question it. And they love it so much. But, I mean, they don't even realize that almost half the country despises it, and they're all white. And I mean, they just, and their concerns are legitimate. Their hatred is legitimate because they
mm-hmm.
are constantly shitting on their culture, shitting on who they are and their history. And it's pathetic. And it's really pathetic what my people have tolerated and have really fought for a while now.
Right.
And it's starting to break down, I think, more and more and more, especially with my crowd, my generation, because they're more sophisticated. They can see past the bullshit easier than, say, the baby boomers could.
Right, yeah. And, you know, in that way, of sorts, their mission is accomplished, you know.
Yeah.
But they will have to start anew soon, I believe, you know, because your generation is more aware, you know, and that will breed more awareness as you all
yeah.
proliferate.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll let you go, Siegfried. It was
okay.
a pleasure.
That's same.
Bye.
Same here. Goodbye. Thank you for the call.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Great. Okay. That was, ladies and gentlemen, that was the first time a lady has called into any of my broadcasts, much to my own surprise. But I, not that I'm putting down at all. I'm in fact very happy about that. Okay. Anyway. yeah. Well, I was going to read something rather heady. I hope you can follow along because it's rather intense intellectually. This is to just give some sort of explanation as to what nature is and our state within it. And yeah, here we go. This is from Immanuel Kant's Critique of Judgment, and it's from the second book called The Analytic of the Sublime. And this is I don't know what you call it, but part 28 or so. It's called Nature as Might. And here he explains man's place in nature and our place in the whole cosmos. So it's pretty intense. And here we go. Might is a power which is superior to great hindrances. It is termed dominion if it is also superior to the resistance of that which itself possesses might. Nature, considered in an aesthetic judgment as might that has no dominion over us, is dynamically sublime. If we are to judge nature as dynamically sublime, it must be represented as a source of fear, through the converse, that every object that is a source of fear is in our aesthetic judgment sublime, does not hold. For in forming an aesthetic judgment, the superiority to hindrances can only be judged according to the greatness of that of the resistance. Now that which we strive to resist is an evil, and if we do not find our powers commensurate to the task, an object of fear. Hence, the aesthetic judgment can only deem nature a might, and so dynamically sublime, insofar as it is looked upon as an object of fear. But we may look upon an object as fearful, and yet not be afraid of it, if, that is, our judgment takes the form of our simply picturing to ourselves the case of our wishing to offer some resistance to it, and recognizing that all such resistance would be quite futile. So the righteous man fears God, or gods, without being afraid of him, because he regards the case of his wishing to resist God and his commandments as one which need cause him no anxiety. But in every such case, regarded by him as not intrinsically impossible, he cognizes him as one to be feared. I'm sorry. One sec here. One who is in a state of fear can no more play the part of a judge of the sublime of nature than one captivated by inclination and appetite can of the beautiful. He flees from the sight of an object filling him with dread, and it is impossible to take delight in terror that is seriously entertained. Hence the agreeableness arising from the cessation of the uneasiness is a state of joy. But this, depending upon deliverance from a danger, it is a rejoicing accompanied with a resolve never again to put oneself in the way of the danger. In fact, we do not like bringing back to mind how we felt on that occasion. not to speak of going in search of an opportunity for experiencing it again. Bold, overhanging, and, as it were, threatening rocks, thunderclouds piled up on the vault of heaven, borne along with flashes and peals, volcanoes in all their violence and destruction, hurricanes leaving desolation in their track, and boundless ocean rising with rebellious force, the high waterfall of some mighty river and the like make our power of resistance of trifling moment in comparison with their might. But, provided our own position is secure, their aspect is all the more attractive for its fearfulness. And we readily call these objects sublime, because they raise the forces of the soul above the height of the vulgar commonplace, and discover within us a power of resistance of quite another kind, which gives us courage to be able to measure ourselves against the seeming omnipotence of nature. In the immeasurableness of nature and the inadequacy of our faculty for adopting a standard proportionate to the aesthetic estimation of the magnitude of its realm, we found our own limitation. But with this we also find in our rational faculty another non-sensuous standard, one which has the infinity itself under it as unit, and in comparison with which everything in nature is small, and so found in our minds a preeminence of over nature, even in its immeasurability. Now, in just the same way, the irresistibility of the might of nature forces upon us the recognition of our physical helplessness as beings of nature, but at the same time reveals the faculty of judging ourselves as independent of nature, and discovers a preeminence above nature that is the foundation of a self-preservation of quite another kind from that which may be assailed and brought into danger by external nature. This saves humanity in our own person from humiliation, even though, as human beings, we would have to submit to external violence. In this way, external nature is not aesthetically judged as sublime, insofar as it arouses fear, but rather because it summons our power to regard as small those things of which we are inclined to be solicitous, worldly goods, health, and life, and hence to regard its might as exercising over us and our personality no such rude dominion that we should bow down before it. Once the question becomes one of our highest principles and of our asserting or forsaking them. Therefore, nature is here called sublime, merely because it elevates the imagination to a presentation of those cases in which the mind can come to feel the sublimity of its own vocation, even over nature. This self-esteem loses nothing by the fact that we must see ourselves safe in order to feel this soul-stirring delight, a fact from which it might seemingly be argued that, as there is no seriousness in the danger, so there is just as little seriousness in the sublimity of our spiritual faculty. For here the delight only concerns the vocation of our faculty disclosed in such a case, insofar as this faculty has its root in our nature, although its development and exercise is left to ourselves and remains our responsibility. Here indeed there is truth. No matter how conscious we may be, when we stretch our reflection so far of our actual present helplessness, this principle has doubtless the appearance of being too far-fetched and subtle, and so of lying beyond the reach of an aesthetic judgment. But observation of human beings proves the reverse, and it may be the foundation of the commonest judgments, although one is not always conscious of its presence. For what is it that, even to the savage, is the object of greatest admiration? It is someone who is undaunted, knows no fear, and who, therefore, does not give way to danger, but sets vigorously to work with full deliberation. Even where civilization has reached a high pitch, there remains the special reverence for the soldier, only that there is in then further required of him that he should also exhibit all the virtues of peace, gentleness, sympathy, and even proper care for his own person, and for the reason that in this we recognize that his mind is above the threats of danger. And so, comparing the statesman and the general, men may argue as they please as to the preeminent respect which is due to either above the other. But the verdict of the aesthetic judgment is for the latter. War itself, provided it is conducted with order and a sacred respect for the rights of civilians, has something sublime about it, and gives nature, and gives nations that carry it on in such a manner a stamp of mind. Only the more sublime, the more numerous the dangers to which they are exposed, and which they are able to meet with fortitude. On the other hand, a prolonged peace favors the predominance of a mere commercial spirit, and with it a debasing self-interest, cowardice, and weakness, and tends to degrade the character of the people. So far as sublimity is predicated of might, the solution of the concept of it appears at variance with the fact that we tend to represent God in the tempest, the storm, the earthquake, and the like, as presenting himself in his wrath, but at the same time also in his sublimity. And yet here it would be alike folly and presumption to reimagine a preeminence of our minds over the operations as it appears even over the direction of such might. Here, instead of a feeling of the sublimity of our own nature, submission, prostration, and a feeling of utter helplessness seem more to constitute the attitude of mind befitting the manifestation of such an object, and to be that also more customarily associated with the idea of it on the occasion of a natural phenomena of this kind. In religion, as a rule, prostration, adoration with bowed head, coupled with contrite, timorous posture and voice, seems to be the only becoming demeanor in presence of the divinity, and accordingly most peoples have assumed and still observe this. By the way, this is written in the 18th century. Moving on. Yet this cast of mind is far from being intrinsically and necessarily involved in the idea of the sublimity of a religion and of its objects. The individual that is actually in a state of fear, finding himself good reason to be so, because he is conscious of offending with his evil disposition against a might directed by a will at once irresistible and just, is far from being in the frame of mind for admiring divine greatness, for which a mood of calm reflection and a quite free judgment are required. Only when he becomes conscious of having a disposition that is upright and acceptable to God, do those operations of might serve to stir within him the idea of the sublimity of this being, so far as he recognizes the existence in himself of a sublimity of disposition consonant with the divine will, and is thus raised above the dread of such operations of nature in which he no longer sees God pouring forth his wrath. Even humility, taking the form of an uncompromising judgment upon his shortcomings, which, with the consciousness of good intentions, might readily be glossed over on the ground of the frailty of human nature, is a sublime temper of the mind voluntarily to undergo the pain of a remorse as a means of more and more effectually eradicating its cause. In this way, religion is intrinsically distinguished from superstition, which latter rears in the mind not reverence for the sublime, but dread and apprehension of the all-powerful being. To those will, terror-stricken man sees himself subjected, yet without according him due honor. From this nothing can arise but grace-begging and vain adulation, instead of a religion consisting in a good life. Sublimity, therefore, does not reside in any of the things of nature, but only in our own mind. Insofar as we may become conscious of our superiority over nature within, and thus also over nature without us, everything that provokes this feeling in us, including the might of nature, which challenges our strength, is then, though improperly called sublime, and it is only under presupposition of this idea within us, and in relation to it, that we are capable of attaining to the idea of the sublimity of that being which inspires deep respect in us, not by the mere display of its might in nature, but more by the faculty which is harbored in us, of judging that might fear, that might without fear, and of regarding our vocation as sublimely exalted above it. We're back. Thank you for sticking around, live listeners and in the archives. That last Kant piece, again, that was from the Critique of Judgment. And, you know, and in that one passage, he encapsulated something that I slowly learned over time, that just the ability for humans to observe nature and make past judgments on it and use it to inspire themselves to create art is a phenomena that is, as far as we know, unique to us and us only. And that's something to relish and honor and even explore philosophically, which Kant obviously did, because he goes on to explore that throughout this tome. I actually recommended it to a friend for summer reading, and you know, she didn't think it was great summer reading at all. So then I recommended Kurt Vonnegut Jr., and she thought that was a better idea. But yeah, anyway, digressing. this piece, I think, you know, coming to that realization about humans and their place in the cosmos, it's, you know, that's it's the human journey in a nutshell. You know, we have all this amazing scientific advancements, white or East Asian, or South Asian, yes, anyway. Yeah, those scientific advancements, it's just, to me, it's a beautiful story, just exploring the advancements that technologically that we've been able to create amidst the we survived the Ice Age to build these civilizations despite the racial diversity in Europe alone, such a small place and so many different tribes and ethnicities. Despite all of that, we were able to create these amazing, mighty civilizations. And, you know, nature influenced the medieval time period. We had the medieval warm period in which we had wineries in England. And then the little ice age affecting the wars, of course, and the whole geography of the earth. Influenced not only our homelands and the way we developed and the way our wars went on and what strategic points we had to capture, like Monte Cassino was just talking about in the beginning of the show. The earth, how it's structured, who occupied the nice little places where sugar plantations and coffee plantations and mine, you know, fertile mines could be created for gems over in South America and the Caribbean. You know, that influenced the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the British, the Dutch going out west into the Caribbean, conquering those areas, bringing in slaves to work the mines and plantations, and eventually getting destroyed, like in Haiti. So yeah, nature dictates the way we act, the way we approach each of our problems, and whether they be natural or unnatural, which I will get to now. Since we're almost done here, I suppose I'll start reading this now. This is the reason why today's show is called The Proving Ground. This is something of my own creation. And, well, stick with me for the next, 10 minutes or so. This piece, again, called The Proving Grounds, is, well, it's half sarcastic and half serious. So it starts off being rather ridiculous. So a little warning here. I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. Let us pray, and be but mere prey. This is the day that the Jew hath made. Let us always stay safe, fat, and happy, and never question their place in the West. Let us never deride what the Jewish major news networks tell us. Let us always boost their egos by bestowing them with the title of mainstream media. Let us never address the fact that Jewish senators not only go on to be re-elected, but viciously attack both the right to bear arms as well as the white people who possess them. They are mere backwards rednecks, living in the squalor-filled South and the appropriately named flyover country. They're old-fashioned and outdated, while the Jews in government and media are progressive. Let us never realize Mikey Chertoff, Paulie Wolfowitz, and Billy Kristol are ever present in world affairs and U.S. federal policy, despite being in the last president's administration and not the current one. Let us never be outraged by the fact that Obama's former chief of staff is the son of an Israeli terrorist and is, like most other Jewish statesmen, tied to the Zionist occupational organization over in Palestine. Let us never be offended by Obama's declaration of Jewish Heritage Month, his pilgrimages to that evil site known as the Wailing Wall, nor his abject opposition to the Yule Tree. Let us never bring to light the fact that he is connected to the hip with an admitted Jewish terrorist, Bill Ayers. One moment, please. Okay. Let us never, ever attempt to revise and destroy the lies shouted about our people's efforts and actions during the Second World War and before. To do such is to be a racist, a bigot, a hater, discriminatory, anti-Semitic. Too bad the truth is anti-Semitic. For the white man or woman to complain about their predicament in this pathetic world is way out of line and offensive. Didn't you hear? Whites are privileged. There's nothing to complain about. You must ignore the limitless examples of savage, lethal, family-destroying, animalistic, and malevolent crimes incurred upon innocent white people, young and old, from the so-called humans of African persuasion we are supposed to call our brothers and fellow citizens. You must also ignore the intense nationalism and racialism of the modern-day Aztec horde. With great ease, they crossed the border, thanks to the loving and sacred papacy, with their sanctuary cities, egalitarian attitude, and forgiving platitude. The demographics of the mestizo and of the Negro skyrockets, while the white one not only ages and stagnates, but becomes further lost in the so-called quote-unquote culture of this dark age. Don't like it, you stupid racist? Move back to Europe, gringo. Now, I could call you cracker, too, without fear of censorship. Why? Chris matted toupee wearer Matthews can sling offensive words against what I think is his own race all day long on MSNBC. Nice job, General Electric. Nice job. Now, when you arrive in London, Stockholm, Malmo, Oslo, Berlin, Roma, Athens, or Paris, try to ignore the rabid bands of culturally muddy Muslim miscreants shouting and or attacking you for mayhaps trying to uphold your native ways. And by native ways, I mean civilized European ways. Not only must you open the borders to these quote-unquote people and tolerate their sick and antiquated value system, but you must never attempt to attack their right to free exercise of religion. Come on, they're like any other people. Normal people riot over cartoons. Normal people stab lingerie store clerks for not being submissive to Allah. Normal people endorse rape jihad. Normal people leech off the system that benevolently let them in. Not satisfied with the state of your homeland? Well, then it's off to Australia with you. When you get there, don't mind the oppressive and bitch of the British Bank's government. Pay no heed to the influx of useless criminal non-white immigrants. Even after stumbling upon, lethargically even, the startling statistics that give this Western world its exotic flair, you must go on to ignore but also embrace it. Just smile and turn the other cheek, Aryan Goy. You are ensnared by each and every one of their traps. Whether it's the castrated worldview of multiculturalism or the soft, ignorant, and traitorous conservative camp, you got your ideals satiated. It's not like the open borders, crumbling economies, nanny-slash-police-state measures, proliferation of digital toys, mind-numbing-slash-culturally-vapid media, and the Abrahamic faiths all have one common rotten root, is it? No, no, no. It couldn't be that simple. Such reality couldn't have any historical backing, that's for sure. Never any time in Europe's long, long chronicles in which an Angevin king expelled Jews from England. Never any time the Poles, Belarusians, Ukrainians, or Russians violently chased down the Jews within their realms. Never a time was there that Jews controlled the money and religion of Europe. Never was there a time that court Jews and street Jews colluded with one another to steal the innocence of native European maidens. Oh, stop looking at history with truthful and honest eyes. Oops, I meant hateful and anti-Semitic eyes. Yes, to explore the Jewish construct that is this world is a hate crime. To speak publicly about it is the most taboo Nazi-like thing a white man could do. This seemingly arduous hurdle is the first of many to overcome if you are to awaken anybody. No, but you must treat the masses as the perpetual children they are. Talk about things they can relate to or converse on. To me, the situation is so dire, and the evidence so great in quantity and disgusting in quality, that to baby these imbeciles towards the truth of the eternal Jew is seriously part of the problem. Not one step backwards, as Sir Rodney Martin has declared. Give no more leeway to the beast and its many minions. As strong as the Weltschmerz that I have become afflicted with may be, it is nothing, nothing compared to the sadness swelling within the parents of a young girl murdered by black animals. The frustration of the small-town working man losing work to cheap neo-serf labor of the Aztec. The confusion and disgust of the young boy or girl force-fed politically correct toleration of homosexuality. The anger of the honest and perhaps patriotic government bureaucrat in Europe who is powerless to halt the subterfuge and immolation of their fatherland. This age is the proving grounds, the time that separates the racially loyal from criminally complacent, the era which divides our race between those courage-filled and those of a meek mindset, the time period that titillizes the easily entranced and makes pariahs out of the noble and honest among us. How long will it be till the golden age is here? To mull over such fantasies is pleasing, and in some cases needed. But what must be the prerogative now is perhaps only this: declaration. Having the fortitude and knowledge to openly declare what is right in the world and what is so dreadfully wrong with it. Do not let the sob stories of some of your peers guiltfully shrugging off criticisms on, say, the Negroids, disrupt your open and mighty fact-filled condemnation of their race. Do not let the kosher cult dictate who are your heroes, your concerns, and your opinions. Choose which men and women you wish to venerate. Study up on history and current events to be able to legitimately form your own thoughts. I know such a solution is rather sparse in detail or visceral action. The action is found within those we already would have found deep objection with. People of a different and totally incompatible religion, moving in somewhere where it is frowned upon to practice such, never yields any good. But the leftists would bawl and say, we whites are privileged. Oh, really? The Constitution, framed by Englishmen and given a chance to exist by German, Irish, Scottish, French, and other ethnicities by way of their blood sacrifice, fighting in fighting the House of Hanover's imperialist troops isn't enough to call the USA a white country, for whites, by whites. No kidding, we're privileged. A country settled generations before even the revolution occurred. A country that for years to come would wrestle with theocratic firebrand Christians and invasive Jews to maintain a place for their populace. But no, facts never do sway the opinions of the Antifa rabble. And declaring your stance as a racialist while reciting such obvious facts will never do anything to sway their opinion. Such weaklings and idiots don't even deserve our help. Those who stay quiet are merely maintaining the white American tradition of the chill effect. The late, great Ravello Pendleton Oliver detailed the growth and objectives of the anti-communist since the 1920s. This can be heard and seen in the video made for the National Youth Alliance dated 1969. In that talk, he remarked on how the John Birch Society types remained in the dark and deeply within the guilt-inducing allied narrative and could and would never address the real problems marring these United States. He would later go on as to the topic of that talk, refer to the youth of his day. That is, both the unkempt, galvanized, and tool of the Jew hippie types, as well as, and more importantly, the conservative young men and women that stayed silent, watching in horror as their generational peers suckled at the decrepit Semitic teat of multiculturalism. Much is to be compared to that baby boomer era and my own. Only that this time, in popular lexicon and perception, as dictated by Jewish news networks, views of the conservative or Tea Party whites as the only extremists this country has. They think the rest of the country is so oblivious and foolish as to believe such. Sadly, they are almost completely correct. However, I find it hard to believe that I am but a mere anomaly on this Jewish wet dream, Long Island, the haven of both opportunistic immigrants and drug-addled, TV-worshipping suburbanites. I am indeed a rarity. But all over this white diaspora worldwide, there simply must be more men like I. Honest, polite, courageous, intelligent, knowledgeable, gentlemen, disillusioned by their respected colleges and or communities for their lack of action. The lack of awareness, too, is the spark that should galvanize these like-minded comrades into doing the same as I. They scarcely even call into the show. It will take these future leaders to at least muster the courage to spearhead real change. For the dividing lines are set, women acting as mud sharks, conservatives bending over for kosher talking points, liberals lost in eternal hypocrisy, these are the dividing lines, make no mistake about it. These are the proving grounds. It will take many, many people in the youth, like me, to declare unequivocally the following. I give my life and every fiber of my being to my race, and to at least the mere chance that the golden age may be made a reality. These times and usurped lands are the proving grounds. The evidence is on our side. Which side are you on? The one of laziness, hypocrisy, and weakness, or that of honor, loyalty, race, and the unhindered will to conquer or die? Thank you all. Thank you so much for listening live and in the archives. Thank you so much. I'm going to wrap it up here. We got less than 3 minutes here. I don't believe I read this over the air yet, so if I did, I'm very sorry to the loyal listeners, but I have a poem here written on the 23rd of April, 2013. It's called Your Feelings Are Irrelevant. So I'll wrap up the show with this one. It's rather biting. The truth knows no loyalty. The no lofty creed it abides. And sooner or later, the bloated body of deceit will be washed away by the waves of reality, until this a jangled mess of lies goes untouched. We await the day it subsides. But why the waiting? With the facts on our side, there is nothing to fear. Unless, of course, it is the softness of your cohorts and friends which dictates your sense of duty and disapproval to see the wicked system being the world's end. The simple feelings of yours and your ignorant social circles is inferior to the truth. If sadness, disappointment, and ridicule is something you cannot deal with, being thrown into your midst, then look back. The instinct and fervor of a champion. You are but a champion of nothing but inactivity and complacency, part of the problem. The will to power and urge to fight, to alight the minds and nations, to triumph, to truth of our predicament, is the saving grace. Rest easy, if you die, one branded an enemy, even if the lies continue for eons, you will live on in the pantheon of champions. Thank you so much. Thank you to Archangelo Corelli, Severus Reed, Mike Sledge's girl, Francesco Saverio Geminiani, Pietro Locatelli, and of course the one and only Antonio Vivaldi for all the music, all the calls, all the kind words. Thank you all so much. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, der Sieg ist unser. Thank you so much. Vielen Dank. Good night. Take it easy. I might appear on the roundtable tomorrow. We will see. Thank you again. Good night.